Governor Herbert recognizes Patriot Day. The Utah Department of Health moves forward with a controversial overhaul of Medicaid. And University of Utah professor Dan McCool is optimistic about the state of the country's rivers. You're listening to the KUER News Pod for Tuesday, September 11th. I'm Brian Grimmett. Governor Gary Herbert has ordered flags at state facilities to be flown at half staff in remembrance of the September 11th terrorist attacks. Herbert issued a statement saying Utah would never forget one of the nation's darkest days and the deaths of nearly 3,000 people in the attacks 11 years ago. Congress has designated the anniversary as Patriot Day and also as a national day of service and remembrance. Herbert and his staff are launching a food drive to mark the day of service and plan to donate the goods to the Utah Food Bank later this month. A number of other service projects are planned to mark the anniversary. Information is available at volunteers.utah.gov. The Utah Department of Health is moving forward on an overhaul of the Medicaid system despite opposition. Utah's new managed care contracts are designed to save the state money and are slated to go into effect in January, but some health advocates say the proposed contracts do not ensure quality care for patients, and the state's inspector general says the contracts do not ensure proper oversight of Medicaid funds. KUER's Andrea Smartin reports.
Brent James is the chief quality officer at Intermountain Healthcare. In his office in the KeyBank building in downtown Salt Lake, there's a small telescope that he uses to watch the falcon nest in the neighboring building. But James doesn't have time to look at birds these days. Instead, he's training his eye on a problem.
You know, I'm at a point in my career when I was hoping it would slow down, but instead it's accelerating massively. As a country, we really do face a problem relative to our finances. When you look at the details of it, it's frankly scary. Two-thirds of the problem is healthcare. Well, I would rather be part of the solution than part of the problem.
James travels the country to talk about Intermountain's approach to improving efficiencies in healthcare. Intermountain has been implementing aspects of what's called accountable care. James says it's like the managed care that was introduced in the 90s with the advent of health maintenance organizations, or HMOs, where a fixed sum of payment is provided to care for a population of patients. But James says the new idea of accountable care is better for two reasons.
The first is rather than asking an insurance company to be accountable for the care, we're asking care delivery groups, physicians really, to be accountable for the care. And the second is in the last 20 years, our data systems have improved massively. So rather than just trust us, the care is going to be okay, hard data to show that we're delivering better care.
Intermountain began implementing accountable care 12 years ago in its diabetes clinic. They kept reports on every patient that came in and deployed nurses with evidence-based practice tools. Anytime a diabetic patient appeared, the nurse or doctor had a full summary of the care they had received and had tools to advise them on next steps. All the while, the clinic continued to collect and analyze the data. Plus, the physicians receive some financial incentive for good health outcomes.
You know, if I can manage your diabetes well enough, you won't need to go in the hospital. And if I avoid the hospital, I've just saved a lot of money, thousands, tens of thousands of dollars for just you. And the reason I saved the money is because your health is better.
James says this approach was associated with massive improvements in diabetes outcomes. In 2 years, the numbers of patients hospitalized with complex diabetes fell from 39% to 31%. Mortality rates fell by 3 percentage points. James says he's seen accountable care work, and it gives him hope that the healthcare crisis can be solved.
It's not just saving healthcare that we're talking about. In my more grandiose moments, I think that we're saving the country. I mean, this could turn around the budget of the United States. This could help turn around the deficit spending that we all face. This is the hope for the future in a very real sense.
Now, the state of Utah is trying to do what Intermountain has piloted on a large scale with Medicaid patients. The legislature passed Senate Bill 180 in 2011, requiring the Department of Health to develop a proposal to change the fee structure for Medicaid providers in order to curb state spending. As of January 1st, the state is set to pay Intermountain and three other Medicaid providers a capped payment per patient. It's up to the providers to figure out how to deliver care for less. But some healthcare advocates say the state's proposal doesn't do enough to ensure quality standards across the board. Judy Hillman is executive director of Utah Health Policy Project. At a meeting last week with health advocates, providers, and state health officials, she expressed her disappointment with the health department's proposal.
What's frustrating is that we have the expertise in our healthcare delivery system to deliver care in this fashion, but we're not tying it together in a way where we can compare the plans on quality and where that comparison is transparent to the consumers.
Hillman is concerned that there are not adequate mechanisms to track and report the quality of care provided.
This is not accountable care by any stretch. And it's with great sadness and disappointment that I say that, because I think that accountable care is the way to go for Medicaid. And I also think that it's a way to satisfy our fiscal hawks, our leaders' appetite for true cost containment. That was the path forward, and we've fallen off the path.
Before the meeting, State Medicaid Director Michael Hales told KUER that the health department has been listening to public input throughout the process and will take UHPP's comments under advisement.
We're very open to public participation, not only from clients, advocacy groups, as well as providers, in terms of finding the most meaningful way to measure quality and make sure that we're delivering the appropriate care to those who need it most.
But Hales said the department may not have time to make changes before the contract is finalized. He plans to send the proposal to the federal government for approval by the end of this month. The state's inspector general is conducting an audit of the proposal, also due out later this month. The office declined to comment because the audit is ongoing, but in an August memo to the Department of Health, Lee Wyckoff said he was concerned the contract lacks proper oversight of Medicaid funds and doesn't make providers accountable for care standards. While the state finalizes its proposal, Utah's Medicaid providers are bracing for a big change. Brent James says it will be a challenge for all providers, but he believes if accountable care is done right, it can improve the quality of care.
Better care nearly always costs less if you set it up right. You don't achieve cost savings by withholding care. You achieve cost savings by improving care.
Andrea Smartin, KUER News.
LDS Hospital in Salt Lake City held a grand reopening ceremony Monday after a five-year-long renovation. KUER's Bob Nelson reports.
Administrator Jim Sheets says the renovations began in 2007 when Intermountain Medical Center opened in Murray and several services moved there, creating more space.
We've invested about $32 million over the last 5 years to renovate the hospital. So we went and remodeled pretty much every patient care area, every public space to bring it up to a higher standard. So while it's not new, it's a new hospital. This main lobby was closed down and then we've reopened it a different configuration and a kind of a brighter, newer feel, more modern.
Sheets says the center has been redefined as an elite community hospital with access to the staples of general surgery, labor and delivery and imaging, but also has niche services such as an expanded bone marrow clinic for leukemia patients and a new weight loss surgery program. The number of hospital beds was cut in half, making room for larger patient rooms, as well as an expansion of the Women's Health Center and Behavioral Health Unit.
Incumbents are getting the lion's share of special interest money in Utah legislative campaigns, meaning state residents likely won't see many competitive races come November. The Salt Lake Tribune reports the average incumbent has outraised a challenger by a nearly 5-to-1 margin. Two-thirds of that cash comes from corporations, political action committees, and lobbyists. Utah has no limits on contributions to state political races. Brigham Young University political science professor Quinn Monson says the numbers are lopsided because special interests want to give money to the likely winner and don't want to risk angering a candidate who will end up in office. Blendtec, a company based in Orem that invented a new kind of blender jar, has won a patent infringement lawsuit against a competitor, Vitamix. The Provo Daily Herald reports the U.S. Court of Appeals has upheld a pair of judgments in favor of Blendtec. The five-sided blender jar is more efficient because it makes the spinning vortex move around instead of just staying in the center of the jar. The judgment requires Vitamix to pay more than $24 million for patent infringement. Salt Lake City officials announced the beginning of Idle Free Awareness Month this morning. Mayor Ralph Becker kicked off the event by talking to elementary school students in Rose Park about the importance of turning off a car when it's parked for more than a few seconds. KUER's Whitney Evans reports.
City leaders explained to 4th, 5th, and 6th graders at Rose Park Elementary that idling a vehicle increases dependence on oil, reduces the fuel economy of a car, costs more money, and produces harmful pollutants. Mayor Ralph Becker offered tips on how they can help their parents minimize those effects.
So when you're parked and waiting somewhere, whether it's your parents picking you up from school, whether it's when you go to a grocery store, when you go out and play at a playground and people are turning their key, the idea is to be idle free.
Nicole Warren is principal at Rose Park Elementary. She says in a survey the school conducted last year, parents said one of their biggest concerns is the amount of pollution their children breathe in the city.
The sooner we can make our kids aware, the more helpful they'll be in terms of changing their parents' bad behavior. And I won't call it bad behavior, their parents' habitual behavior, and also mapping out what their behavior will be in the future.
Last year, the Salt Lake City Council passed a law to make it illegal to idle for more than 2 minutes. Whitney Evans, KUER News.
The head of the University of Utah's Environmental and Sustainability Studies program says he's optimistic about the future of rivers across America. In his new book, River Republic, Professor Dan McCool argues this is happening because Americans are learning the value of their rivers, not for irrigation or hydropower or transportation, but for their own sake. KUER's Dan Baumas sat down with Professor McCool and had this conversation.
The focus of the book is the United States as a whole, but I do look at a lot of exciting new developments in the American West. There's a lot happening here. And I think as water becomes more scarce and as we begin to value rivers for their own sake, an intact, clean river has value to society, to our economy, to our quality of life. And as we increasingly recognize that, there's going to be, this sounds like a harsh word, but in essence, a reckoning. We're looking at what we've done to rivers, and they're no longer, in many cases, meeting our needs. What we want from rivers is quite different from what we've done to rivers.
There are rivers in areas such as California, Washington, Oregon, where dams that were built a century ago, perhaps, are being removed.
Yes.
Give us some examples of what's going on there.
Well, dam removal is just one strategy out of many different strategies to restore and protect rivers. And in fact, most river restoration projects do not involve dam removal. But those are the ones that get the most press because they're very dramatic, and it makes for good coverage when you see a high explosive taking out part of a dam. But there's several examples just from the past year. The Elwha River in Washington on the Olympic Peninsula had two dams on it. They produced a very small amount of hydropower, originally intended for a lumber mill that no longer functions. But they completely destroyed a beautiful anadromous fish run. I think there were seven different species, literally tens of thousands of salmon. It's a bad trade-off. It's a bad deal. We got a very small benefit out of those dams and a very large cost. So it truly made sense to remove both Elwha Dam and Glines Canyon Dam. And in fact, Elwha Dam is now gone, and they're chipping away at Glines Canyon. Glines Canyon happens to be in Olympic National Park, and they're basically going to return that site to a natural feature. It's a beautiful place. I've been there. And it's a great improvement on that river.
Well, the elephant in the room, especially for us here in Utah, is the Glen Canyon Dam.
First of all, Glen Canyon Dam is not coming out. That's not going to happen. Let's just recognize the reality of that. If someone proposed to build that today, it would not happen. But it's there. So politics is not going to remove Glen Canyon Dam. However, I think upstream diversions and changing water priorities and climate change are going to drain Lake Powell. It's not going to be drained because environmentalists want it to be drained, reality is going to drain Lake Powell.
In the end, then, do you feel that our society is learning to value its rivers in ways that perhaps it did not before?
I really do. In fact, that's a major theme in River Republic. So many of the people I interviewed, I mean, I have to confess I had a lot of fun going around the country, putting in a lot of river miles and talking with a lot of people involved in these projects. And what I really enjoyed about it is that it has nothing to do with ideology. That this is one area that I don't think has been poisoned by the ideological toxins that are, I think, have invaded national politics. These people, it doesn't matter whether they're liberal or conservative or Democrat or Republican. They look at a local river and they used to fish there when they were little, or they used to boat there and it used to be beautiful and their families went there. And now it's not available for that. And they feel like they've been deprived of something of value to their community. So river restoration is community restoration. It's economic development. It's a recognition that our economy has changed and we need to change our rivers to accommodate that new economy with a focus on tourism and in some cases real estate development and recreation and scenery and sometimes habitat protection and fishing and hunting. So a lot of these projects to restore rivers are supported by this vast panoply of stakeholders that run the gamut from hunters and fishers to the greens and the enviros and the local real estate developer and local businesses and the recreation industry. It's amazing that a river can bring all these people together. When they might disagree on everything else, they all agree that they love their local river.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right.
Dan McCool is director of the Environmental and Sustainability Studies Program at the University of Utah. His book, River Republic, is published by Columbia University Press.
Relatives of a Boy Scout killed by lightning last year are suing the Boy Scouts organization, claiming leaders weren't properly trained to respond to dangerous weather. The parents of David Rayborn and his best friend Sean Smith says the boys should have been instructed to seek shelter in a permanent structure rather than walking to a ridgetop campsite further away. Rayburn died and Smith was indirectly hit and tried unsuccessfully to revive his friend. University of Utah quarterback Jordan Wynn has decided to end his football career after yet another shoulder injury. He's looking at a fourth surgery to repair the damage he suffered in the Utes game with the Utah State Aggies last Friday. Coach Kyle Whittingham revealed the news yesterday after he talked to Wynn and Wynn talked to his father. Whittingham says senior John Hayes and freshman Travis Wilson will battle out this week for the right to start Saturday's game against BYU. And finally, the King's English Bookstore turned 35 years old yesterday. Dan Bomas has that story.
Betsy Burton started her independent bookstore on the corner of Emerson Avenue and 15th East and watched technology change her business drastically. Burton says e-books have become very popular, but she's confident the old-fashioned kind will continue to be a special part of people's lives.
But people forgot the heft and the feel of a book and the pages and the turning of pages, and they forgot that they really loved that, and now they're remembering.
Burton says a strong sense of customer loyalty and an awareness about buying local have helped the store persevere during tough economic times.
The importance of community and the importance of books mean, although it's been a roller coaster, I think that our future is assured and we will go on.
Children's author Mo Willems and New York Times best-selling author Elizabeth George will be at the King's English later this week to read from their new books.
And that is your KUER News Pod for Tuesday, September 11th. For the latest news and updates from around the state, be sure to check us out online at KUER.org. Until next time, I'm Brian Grimmett.